I don't have any opening comments, but we'll just jump right into it. So at the conclusion of the last work session, we talked about the transcript that was being recorded or transcribed and wanting to get our hands on that and get through it and really focus in on the record as it relates to all the environmental issues. And there weren't really, in our last session, a lot of other outside issues, but I wanted to, beyond the environmental impacts, but I wanted to open it up for the two of you if you had anything outside of the environmental impacts that you wanted to talk about first today as it relates to this project. And then I thought we'd go into the environmental stuff.
Not outside of environmental.
Okay. And you? Okay. All right. Very good. That's been my focus as well. So
I think maybe one, but just I had questions last time about a piece of railroad right-of-way.
Okay.
And my understanding from talking to Brian is that right-of-way has been acquired.
The right-of-way has been acquired.
Or maybe was acquired before, but it's taken care of.
It's been taken care of with the railroad, yep.
So that's
okay.
No longer.
All right. So one thing that I had asked and had worked with Brian on is to go through sort of the line by line on the Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, their input on this, their concerns, and then compare that to what was provided at the hearing in terms of response from the company on those issues, and then also to some degree also what's in the record in terms of their studies and filings. And so Brian did that and provided a summary, which I understand both of you guys have received as well. And it's a pretty helpful document to go through sort of each of the issues, that main issues that were raised. So I thought today we would talk through some of those bigger ones and just have a discussion about it for the folks in the room, just a little bit of information about what a work session is. So three of us can't talk or discuss cases at all outside of a public meeting. So this opportunity is really for us to share with each other what concerns we have, what kinds of questions we have, and how we're viewing some of these issues, and learn from each other and benefit from each other's analysis as if you will, of the issues. And then ultimately, I mean, maybe we all have our decision made. Probably we don't. And so then take that information and help use it to make a decision. So that's really the whole point of this work session. And so we'll just have that conversation with our staff, Jerry and attorney Brian, and see where we end up. Did both of you have a chance to read or get through some of this? Yep. Okay, good. Brian, I've kind of narrowed it down. Would you prefer to take the lead on going through this, or are you okay with me going through it and kind of in the categories that I've sort of compartmentalized it?
I'm fine with you taking the lead on it. I don't want to talk about stuff that's not
okay.
Concern of yours.
But if there are things that we don't bring up that you think are concerns and should discuss, please make sure to do that when we at some point this afternoon.
Sure.
Because just because we haven't identified it doesn't mean we shouldn't be thinking about it. So ultimately, what I appreciate about this document is towards the end, Brian really kind of focused us in on what it is that we're to be thinking about and concerned about. And what page is that, Brian, where you go through the three questions? I wanted to restate those.
Page 20. End of page 20, beginning of page 21.
Yeah. No. Oh, here we are. So here's our questions. Will the location and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and welfare of the citizens of North Dakota? Are the proposed facilities compatible with environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in orderly and timely fashion? So those are our three big issues. I think, you know, the company in putting together its application believes that they've met those. And I guess our job is to determine if they have. So Game and Fish, U.S. Fish and Wildlife have identified a number of big issues. The first issue that Brian goes through is the native impact on native prairie. And just in a summary, my view of the company's efforts on native prairies, they've significantly reduced the impact on the direct impact on native prairie and have, like, what is it, 5 of 76 turbines sited on either broken prairie or cropland.
I believe it's 7. I think it's 7. 5 on broken prairie and 2 on cropland.
Okay. Hayland, yeah. The rest are on cropland or broken prairie.
Right.
So I think that, you know, they also have mentioned that they, and in the record states that they've avoided the Dakota Skipper habitat, identified habitat. With that, Game and Fish, I think it's Game and Fish, points out that a large portion of the wind resource area and transmission line is composed of native unbroken prairie. That's 55%, which may support 30 or more of the 115 species of conservation priority identified in the State Wildlife Action Plan. So despite moving it off of the, you know, off of these, it's, I think what I read that Game and Fish should be saying is the whole project area has a lot of native prairie. And is that kind of how you would characterize that, Brian?
I would. I guess I would note that that was the May 22nd, 2018 letter, so I believe that would have been referencing the 300-megawatt project and not the 200-megawatt project at that time.
Yeah, that's a confusing piece about this, and it's really important to keep that those separate. Is there an updated number for that particular stat?
With respect to the native prairie issue for that Game and Fish pointed out, I don't believe that they updated that figure.
Okay.
If they did, I don't recall, but it would be in the record.
Yeah.
That's in like 5.78 total acres in unbroken grasslands.
Right. But when I'm I think what they were getting at with what I read in the May 22nd letter is that that's the impact, but the broader impact of how many acres around that are native prairie, where all these critters are living. And, you know, whether we should be concerned about that or not, that's our question. Game and Fish is. U.S. Fish Wildlife is. So do you guys have any thoughts or concerns you want to talk about on the native prairie stuff or conclusions?
It probably is an area where the company, you know, did a pretty good job by lowering the output of the project and getting off of that east end where things seem to be the worst and lessening the number of turbines on the native grasses. So
yeah,
that's a positive.
Yep, I think so. I read it that way too, Randy, that the native prairie impacts are one of the areas where they've mitigated the most, done the most mitigation. And that follows with the letter that that John DiDonato wrote to Game and Fish to a number of those items relate to reducing impact to native prairie. Okay. Brian, anything else we should talk about with regards to native prairie?
The only other thing that I think would be subject to discussion with native prairie would be the transmission line.
Right.
There was an updated map that depicted the amount of poles, poles that would support the highline wire that would go across, and their impact on native prairie. I didn't see an updated calculation as to how many acres would be impacted as a result of the transmission line. But just going through and looking at the map, it's kind of hard to tell whether some of the poles are actually on Native Prairie or not physically on Native Prairie, because they're kind of right in an area where the two parts intersect. So, you know, I looked and I counted, and I got between 70 and 80 of those poles would be arguably on Native Prairie. I think that number could fluctuate probably 10 in either direction, depending on how you want to read the map. But that would have been late filed exhibit number 50.
Mm-hmm.
So with respect to Native Prairie, that would be the only other thing I think that would be worthwhile to discuss.
Well, I'm just going to say that I don't find that to be a big issue in my mind. You know, if you're building a transmission line mm-hmm. along the border of a piece of cropland, but you put the structures out in the grass so people don't have to farm around them, you're not really dissecting the middle of a, you know, significant piece of grassland somewhere. You're right on the edge, and it's just a convenience, and it seems to me like kind of a logical thing to do there. Different when it dissects large acres of valuable unbroken grasslands, but with the transmission line, I didn't have a problem with that.
I also think a couple things on the transmission lines. The pole impact is pretty small. They aren't spinning like a turbine, so the, you know, extent of the, if you want to call it indirect, it's hard to define whether it's direct or indirect, but of the spinning turbine would not exist in a transmission line. And the bird diverters seem to be pretty effective at reducing the impacts to birds on the transmission lines. So I think that, and they have those too, so that's another area where they've done some pretty effective mitigation. So I'm not real concerned about the Native Prairie impact on the transmission line either. Okay, kind of along the same lines as the Dakota Skipper, because that kind of relates to the Native Prairie impact. The company has said that they have no surface impact to Dakota Skipper impact. I can't recall where was the, did the Game Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife agree with that?
U.S. Fish and Wildlife was critical of the study on Native Prairie, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife essentially said that the Dakota Skipper habitat needs to be studied during the non-winter months.
Oh, right.
And there was a portion of the study, I believe, that was done during the winter months on that, so they recommended additional follow-up studies to verify that the portion of Native Prairie would not be suitable for a Dakota Skipper during the relevant time period. But that's really about all that was said from U.S. Fish and Wildlife on that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, since they've reduced the impact on the Native Prairie, it correlates that the potential impact to the Dakota Skipper is also reduced. And I think that in the letter from the company, that sort of summarizes their mitigation. Avoidance of all impacts is suitable habitat for federally listed Dakota Skipper that inhabits specific types of high-quality native prairies. So either of you have additional points to discuss on the Dakota Skipper?
No.
How about you, Brian?
No.
Jerry? Okay. All right. Then I think the other two big categories I want to talk about are the wetlands and endangered species in general. And we can add whatever else you want to talk about in relation to that, but or anything else. But wetlands are sort of the defining issue on this project, it seems to me. the company has taken a liberal view, I would say, of wetland impacts by only focusing on U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wetlands, or largely focusing on that. Would you say that's inaccurate?
I would say that's generally correct. They also did testify that with respect to wetlands that would provide a suitable habitat for the whooping crane that were non-jurisdictional, that they avoided those to the extent practicable as well. But, yes, I think from a general standpoint, your statement fairly summarizes what was in the record.
Even with the draft orders that were developed, I have those here, they use – you know, basically in saying it's an avoidance area, and we've avoided it by staying away from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers jurisdictional wetlands, and then they probably have a statement about the whooping crane stuff, too, in here. Yeah. Berkwind has avoided temporary and permanent impacts, isolated prairie potholes to the extent practicable. The project will permanently impact 1 acre of isolated prairie potholes. All isolated prairie potholes determined suitable stopover habitat for whooping cranes were completely avoided. And then above that, it's 15 USA's jurisdictional wetlands were delineated, and none will be temporarily or permanently impacted. So that's their commentary on wetlands as an avoidance area. You provided an interesting definition from our rules on wetlands, Brian. Can you talk through that a little bit?
Sure. And it's 6906.0101 subsection 16, which is in the North Dakota Admin Code, and it defines a wetland as an aquatic area important to the life stages of certain wildlife species as defined by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And that's what.
And so it doesn't say U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
It does not.
Where does that come from then? Where does the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers focus on the company come from?
The Corps has jurisdiction over wetlands, and if the wetlands are connected to another body's source of water, so that water can transfer from one wetland into another area, they're generally considered to be jurisdictional to the Corps, and they need a permit from the Corps in order to disturb that wetland.
Okay.
Unless they fall under some nationwide permits. There's a couple of them out there for small routine-type projects that you just qualify for them. You don't have to get a special permit for them.
So they would need a permit from the Corps to impact those wetlands, so they had to note that they don't impact them.
That's the delineation that they do. Mm-hmm. They need to know where the borders are for those wetlands so they can stay out of them.
Okay.
Yeah, and with and Jerry's explanation of it was pretty much consistent with what I found. The term that's used in the Code of Federal Regulations is a significant nexus, which sets out, I think it's 9 different factors that each wetland is evaluated upon, and then the Corps ultimately determines whether that is a wetland within their jurisdiction or not. And if it is a jurisdictional wetland, then there has to be a permit or something obtained. So that's essentially what I believe Jerry was referencing.
But our rules speak to a more conservative. I would call it more conservative because it includes more wetlands.
Yeah, I think that it could easily be interpreted that way, yes.
And if I remember right, our rules are different for transmission lines than they are for power plants as to whether or not wetlands are avoidance areas. If I remember it right, I think they are for the power plant, but not for the transmission line.
So for the in power plant, you're talking an electric generation facility?
Yeah.
Okay.
The wind farm.
Okay. So, go ahead.
So for the the transmission line, the wetlands is not a avoidance area? Is that what? Okay.
Okay. Well, the wetlands seem to be a significant source of the concern from the agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Game and Fish, because of their value in terms of breeding grounds and the large, you know, number of birds and wildlife that are making their homes there in this area. So if you look at page 15 of Brian's memo, where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife kind of quantifies, he summarizes their March 6th of 2019, so this is after the reductions in the project footprint. U.S. Fish and Wildlife quantifies their concerns. And number one of that page 15, 24% of the square mile sections within the project area have densities of 200-plus pairs. 85% of the 1 square mile sections in the project area support over 100 pairs of breeding waterfowl, as compared to the statewide average of 11%. So those are pretty strong numbers that quantify impact and the value of this particular area to breeding pairs of waterfowl. And has that been mitigated? How have they mitigated that, Brian, in your...
Well, I think it would be a fair takeaway from the testimony and from their application that their mitigation of impacts to wetlands has been to not place a turbine in a wetland, specifically a jurisdictional wetland, or a wetland where a whooping crane would find it to be a suitable stopover habitat. Other than that, this is where a lot of the testimony that came out at hearing had to do with direct and indirect impacts. And I'm not sure we ever really got a concrete definition of what an indirect impact is in this particular case. I know there was a lot of discussion that happened about that particular issue. The indirect impacts in this case appear to be not calculated to any precision. It appears, at least from reading the transcripts, that NextEra is saying that we don't know exactly where these ducks go. There's no way of saying that they're going to die or anything like that. We just know that some of them might go somewhere else. And I think the number that both NextEra and Fish and Wildlife were able to agree upon was somewhere in the range of 1,000 breeding duck pairs would likely be displaced over the course of this project. So as far as what's been done to mitigate the impact to non-jurisdictional wetlands, it doesn't appear that there's been a lot of I guess, additional consideration given to that other than the non-jurisdictional wetlands that would be a suitable stopover habitat for a whooping crane. And there's not a lot of evidence. It doesn't appear, at least from my review of the record, indicating otherwise.
There is a proposed finding. Burke Wind has avoided temporary and permanent impacts to isolated prairie potholes. Those would be the non-jurisdictional ones. To the maximum extent practicable, the project will permanently impact 1 acre of isolated prairie potholes. All isolated prairie potholes determined suitable stopover habitat for whooping cranes were completely avoided.
And this is where this case is, you know, going to be so critical in how we, the commission and the state, starts how we view direct and indirect, because the company is proposing that if it's not located in within the wetland, then there's not an impact. And when it comes to birds and waterfall, I don't know that a direct impact can be so narrowly considered just because you're not in the wetland. Well, you know, the towers move and spin and they have, you know, so that's their impact is far bigger than just the footprint in the wetland. And you could even say their direct impact is far bigger than that. So, I don't know. I mean, that's, I think, where we really are going to have to figure out how we want to view this.
That is the big dilemma. What the exact definition of direct and indirect and... the differences in the distinction. I don't know exactly what that is either.
Well, and the law doesn't require us to think that narrowly either.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just because we can't say this is direct and this isn't indirect, that we, you know, one means, yeah, it's fine, and the other means, no, it's not. We consider both and the overall impact to the environment as a whole. So we don't have to get, but I do think just from how I'm viewing this, it's not, it doesn't resonate with me that a direct impact is restricted only to the footprint of the tower and the base of a wetland. That's not, that to me is not a reasonable interpretation of an impact for a wind turbine in a wetland. So I don't view it that way at all. And I also don't view the our only concern to be the Corps of Engineers wetlands.
There was a long time ago, I saw some stuff that quantified some indirect impacts, and it would have indirect impacts for things like access roads. The idea being that if you put the road in there, the areas around the road now have a road biome, and the animals and stuff will find it easy to run up and down that road rather than to use the grasslands around it. And so that's kind of an indirect impact. Mm-hmm.
And Commissioner Fedorchak, I think the way you characterize the law doesn't necessarily require you to determine what's a direct impact and what's an indirect impact is correct. I think you're more looking at impacts, mm-hmm. Whether they be direct or indirect, and that there's a statute on that. And it says that adverse, direct, and indirect environmental effects that cannot be avoided should the proposed site or route be designated. That's a statute, mm-hmm. that the legislature has given you for guidance as to whether these projects should be sited or not. So I don't necessarily think that where the rubber meets the road is whether it's a direct impact or whether it's an indirect impact. I think the rubber meets the road on whether it's an impact, period.
You said it better than I could have, but I'll just reiterate it since I was about to. The statement of policy on the whole Siting Act, it talks about effects and impacts. It doesn't specify whether they're direct or indirect or how you would define the exact difference between the two. It's impacts and effects.
You got it. Okay, so any thoughts on wetlands? I mean, to me, they're the biggest impact on this whole deal. They have the greatest concern, and they're tough to mitigate. You can't recreate them. And it, I mean, if you look at what would be estimated here, 236 two-acre wetlands would need to be created or restored to compensate for the loss of wetlands in this project area. 236 two-acre wetlands.
Well, I want to kind of agree with you with a distinction. So, yeah, I agree with you that the impacts, especially on the wetlands, is certainly far greater than the proposed order approving would imply.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to have this distinction, and maybe the wetlands are the biggest issue, but I don't want to completely minimize the grasslands part of it either, because whatever that impact around a turbine, whether you call it direct or indirect or define a certain number of feet or whatever, you move it off of the broken stuff and get it, like we were talking about with the transmission lines, right out on the edge of the prairie, or you take it off the prairie and get it right on the edge of the broken cropland. If it's close, it's still going to extend out there. And so I think even though these many of these have been moved off of native grasslands, the ones that are barely off still have some effect. So I guess I agreed with your overall point. I just don't want to completely focus this just on the wetlands either, but probably is the bigger issue.
Yeah. Well, and I think it speaks to some of the approach that the company used to just define wetlands, or largely, not just, but largely define the wetlands of concern as the U.S. Corps of Engineers delineated or jurisdictional wetlands. And I mean, if that was all the concern, then it would be, you know, I think it would be clear that they've minimized those. But I just don't think, based on this input from both of these agencies, that that's the primary or only source of concern as it relates to the environmental impact in this area.
One thing you were talking about, the 236 two-acre wetlands,
mm-hmm.
That's not a number that's comes from how many wetlands they disturbed. They went around in circles about how many breeding pairs there might be, and if they moved somewhere else, you'd need this many wetlands for them to be able to continue breeding like that. So it was kind of a roundabout thing that they were.
So it's a habitat impact?
It was my understanding that this is a statement from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, mm-hmm. with the 236. It's my understanding that they estimated that would be the amount of additional wetlands that would need to be created to offset the impact that this project would have. That's how I interpreted that number to be, how they derived that number.
Okay, but that would be the impact on breeding pairs.
Yeah.
That's what they used to quantify it.
I believe it was a number they came up with to say if this project goes in to have the same amount of habitat, you need 236 two-acre wetlands.
So, but right before, you know, that's conclusion of the 236 two-acre wetlands is a sentence that reads, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agrees with Burke Wind that an estimated 1,004 breeding pairs of waterfowl may be displaced by the Burke Wind farm.
May be displaced.
Right.
So, I mean, it's...
But it is the best science we have available to us, correct? Or expert opinion, if you will?
I don't know if you could call it science, but yeah.
It's the evidence that's reflected in the record.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, talk about why you don't consider it science. Point me to where you're...
Well, I don't see...
Where that comes from, your dismissal of that.
I don't see them pointing to areas where they've been out and counted pairs and done anything to quantify these numbers. They seem to be speaking generally.
They meaning who?
The Fish and Wildlife or Game and Fish about the area being prime area. And I wouldn't argue with them on that. I think the evidence shows that it is a prime wildlife area up there.
But Jerry, I'm not picking on you, but do you believe that consulting with the 27 agencies that we do through
testing
the setting?
Completed. Testing completed.
I'm not done yet.
Wow.
Testing completed. Testing completed.
That's the fire alarm.
Okay. So I'm sorry, Brian, what were you?
I'm not sure anymore. I think the question was on the 27 agencies, at what point, if we don't believe the information, the responses that we get, and sometimes it's a non-response, which in effect is a response, evidently, no concerns, do you think that's a pointless exercise?
Still not following your question.
Well, if we've got testimony that expresses concern, whether it's from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, North Dakota Game and Fish, the State Historical Society, et cetera, and they express their concerns and that becomes a part of the record, ultimately, what do we do with it? Do we then pick and choose what we like and don't like?
I think you have their opinion here. That they don't like this thing there. It's pretty simple.
Well, Jerry, back to your dismissal of those numbers, because I do think
It says may be affected, and so I think they.
Those are the company's numbers. That's the from the company's study.
And I'm not sure just exactly where the company got those numbers either, but. 1,004 breeding pairs of waterfowl may be displaced. So they went out and they counted stuff and they come up with an idea that maybe about 1,004 breeding pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a May thing. And I don't know where they go if they're displaced. We're displaced to where? I mean, nobody says. So what does it really mean?
Well, there was a place, Brian, if you remember more clearly, where the source of some of this, these numbers comes from in some of the displacement.
It was a simulation
that
was done.
In North Dakota, and based on North Dakota and South Dakota wind farms. Like,
yeah, there was a study that was done on that, and
you referenced
it. Yeah, and I'm looking for it. I believe it was a study, conducted by U.S. Geological Service. And this was primarily related to grassland nesting birds that showed a 53% avoidance over 5 years of post-construction for a wind farm. With respect to waterfowl, I do know that Burke Wind didn't necessarily agree with U.S. Fish and Wildlife's overall characterization of mm-hmm. the impact that this project would have, but the 1,004 number that's coming up with the breeding duck pairs, I believe that was based on a simulation that everyone kind of agreed on. I believe that testimony actually came from the company that they said it would be about 1,000 breeding duck pairs, and that's also what U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ultimately came around to say we can expect this to be the impact moving forward. So there wasn't a dispute on that number.
And I think you can see where the two entities are coming at it from different angles, different motives. One is the company saying 1,000 breeding pairs may be disrupted or displaced or moved. And then on page 10 of what the memo you sent, Brian, North Dakota Game and Fish, talks about a reduction of nearly 3,300 breeding duck pairs. Although I'll admit, in terms of being skeptical, I think those pairs will find another place. So I think reduction is maybe a reduction within the project footprint.
Right, and I believe that 3,300 number was based off of the original 300 megawatt project.
Probably.
I think that's right.
My recollection of the record is that pretty much everyone agreed it would be about 1,000 breeding duck pairs.
I found the reference to the study. So it's on number 3 of page 15. Results and from the U.S. Forest Service letter, results of a robust multi-year, multi-facility study conducted by the USGS revealed that grassland nesting birds tend to avoid industrial turbines placed in their grassland habitats. 7 of 9 grassland species showed turbine avoidance out to 300 meters, and the displacement rate, which averaged 53%, increased every year of the study up to 5 years post-construction. The study received NextEra funding as conducted on operating NextEra wind facilities in North and South Dakota. I'm all for looking at evidence that's questionable, but I don't think we can just dismiss this stuff as being unscientific. That seems like a pretty clear
And quite
reference
frankly,
to study that occurred in our area.
Quite frankly, Commissioners, the evidence in the record is subject to however much weight you wish to give it. So if you want to discount it for some reason, you can. If you want to give it credence, you can do that as well. This is kind of where you guys come into play, and you weigh that evidence and weigh those studies and determine what's persuasive to you.
So you see here it says the avoidance up to 300 meters from these duck pairs. So that's one support that they use for their indirect impacts of being like 300 meters around the turbine.
Right. All right. Let's see. So another big issue relating to the wetlands is the whooping cranes, in terms of them being an endangered species that is known to use the wetlands for their stopover stuff habitat. So on page 18 of Brian's memo, he refers to U.S. Fish and Wildlife's opinions with respect to the whooping crane differs substantially from evidence presented by Burke Wind. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife stated its records reveal over 30 whooping crane stopover locations have been reported since the service began collecting such reports, and these sightings occur within and on all sides of the proposed turbine locations. Is that in the bigger footprint or the smaller footprint?
And I believe that was, it would have been Exhibit 45, page 6. I believe that was the most recent letter
yep.
that was submitted.
March 6th. I have that one here.
So that would have been based off of the 200-megawatt project. Because Fish and Wildlife did update their recommendations based off of the reconfiguration of the project.
All right. So they object to that these are known stopovers locations, and this project is in the center of the whooping crane migration corridor, near the center of the whooping crane migration corridor. So those would be their main objections on the whooping crane issue?
Yeah, and with respect to the whooping crane corridor, again, we have the company. They came out and said that this, while it is in the middle of the corridor, it's not in a densely trafficked area for whooping cranes. And Fish and Wildlife Service disputes that. So, again, that comes down to a dispute of fact that ultimately you're going to have to make a determination as to which side you wish to give the most weight on.
Mm-hmm. What evidence did the company provide to dispute that?
They had the map that was submitted in the application, and they did provide testimony on that. I believe Clayton Derby was the one who provided the lion's share of the testimony on.
Is that the probability?
Yeah, and that probability map shows 100% of them are seen in this area, 85%, 75%, right. And this was right in the middle of the highest sighting area for the migratory corridor for the whooping crane. But there's another map that kind of interpreted that bigger map that showed percentile of actual showings. And the company indicated that the actual project location had a lower percentile of the showings than other areas within that 75% area. So it was kind of a subsection of the overall map. And it was the company's position that this was a lower density site, but it was Fish and Wildlife's position that it was a pretty high density site. And Fish and Wildlife, their studies indicated that there were more whooping cranes observed in that area than the company's studies did. Now, as far as the time frame over which those studies were done, I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head how long Fish and Wildlife Service staked that out and what data they used to support that compared to the company. I think we have a finite amount of time that the company looked at it, and that was another issue that I know was subject to criticism by the agencies, was the duration of the avian use studies for that area. So it's kind of a lot to digest there, I know, but if you have any questions.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. Yeah, their modeling, U.S. Fish and Wildlife's modeling, ranks, shows that much of the Burke project area is suitable stopover habitat, ranked in the top decile of predicted use by whooping cranes. So, Brian, help me remember just from the how it's spelled out in law, what our obligation is in relation to endangered species.
Well, it's an exclusion area. I think their habitat's an exclusion area. But at the end of the day, what we're looking at is, have they mitigated the impact to that habitat? And I think that goes into play with the fact that they didn't put a turbine in the wetlands that were going to be suitable whooping crane habitat. So they didn't go right into that area where there's been a known whooping crane population at various times of the year and put a turbine there. And then again, we're talking, I think, with the testimony at the hearing, say there's either 500 or 600 whooping cranes in the whole world. Mm-hmm. So, it'd be unlikely, I guess, that one of those would just swoop on down and make its home in one of these wetlands, whether it be jurisdictional or not. Mm-hmm. But again, we're talking in areas of gray when we're talking about the whooping crane habitat in these areas, because we do have two different studies. And I know that NextEra's study indicated that there were, I believe it was three that were viewed during the avian use survey, but they were way above where the turbines were and they didn't actually stop over in the area. There's a few different ways you could interpret the whooping crane studies to go in this particular case.
And they do note in their list of kind of their summary of mitigative procedures, the whooping crane notification and curtailment procedure that they have established for the project, which would, you know, shut it down if any were known or seen or sighted. Then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service basically says, you know, they undermine it and said that it's not an effective strategy. I don't know what would be an effective strategy, just basically having people out there just looking for whooping cranes all the time.
Yeah, and again, that's something you guys would have to make the decision on. But I do know that there was testimony about that at the hearing, and I believe they said there would be some type of orientation or something like that for new workers, basically saying, this is a whooping crane. If you see it, stop construction. But again, I know that there's testimony that said that the sandhill crane and the whooping crane can be mistaken sometimes for a novice person. I know I would probably not be able to differentiate between the two of them, but that was essentially what the company said that they would be doing for curtailment on that issue.
Okay. Um, Another, did you guys have any more thoughts on Whooping Cranes?
Well, just that the whole shutting it down when one comes, I've never found that to seem like a very effective sounding strategy from a layperson's view. I mean, if something comes flying in, by the time you shut down the facility, whatever, however slim the chance might be that they're going to hit one, has probably happened by then, I suppose.
I don't think
they come and camp out for weeks at a time.
And one other thing I guess that maybe should be noted just for the purpose of the discussion is the agencies admittedly weren't overly concerned about a strike with a turbine with the Whooping Cranes. It was more the transmission line that they were concerned about. And even the company indicated that the transmission line is a known cause of fatalities for the Whooping Crane, whereas the turbine isn't, whether they just avoid them or they're not attracted to them or whatever. And the company's solution to that was the bird diverters that they'd be putting on the transmission line. So, and I think U.S. Fish and Wildlife acknowledged that that is a mitigation measure that can be taken, and it might help or lessen the problem, but it won't eliminate it completely with respect to the transmission line.
Okay.
So one thought that I had as a layperson on this is that they've never lost a whooping crane to a wind farm.
They know about?
Well, never. That I think the whooping cranes are smarter than they think. And I could see them not seeing a transmission line, but I think they fly higher than that unless they're on a landing, unless they're coming down or taking off. And they're probably looking for stuff when they're coming in, you know, so that they avoid it. Because otherwise, how do you explain that nothing's ever been hit or nothing's ever been lost? That's all the way from here to Texas. We've got wind farms the whole way. Your exclusion area, the exact language is areas critical to the life stages of threatened or endangered animal or plant species.
So is a stopover place critical to the life stages of a animal?
I'm not sure if we have a lot of good expert testimony on that particular issue. And again, this is one area where it does appear the company has taken some mitigative measures to avoid any type of impacts to whooping crane habitat. And I know the maps do kind of go through and depict that. I know Ms. Wells and I had some back and forth trying to figure out how exactly those maps were supposed to be interpreted with respect to the wetlands. And the percentage of wetlands that was a suitable whooping crane habitat was a very small percentage of the overall wetlands of the project.
Okay. All right. Then we've got the Eagles stuff. Eagles aren't endangered, but they're protected, right? So there's still an area of concern, and this seemed to be another point where the company's presentation was looked upon skeptically by the agencies. They questioned their counts, didn't they? And thought that there was a high likelihood that there would be impact to eagles in this project based on their count.
Yeah, it was my understanding that Fish and Wildlife was mostly concerned about it because where there's waterfowl, there's generally eagles. And since this is a high-density area for waterfowl, it stands to reason that eagles would be there. At least that's what I took Fish and Wildlife's correspondence to mean. That's obviously open to interpretation. But that was, I guess, kind of the nuts and bolts of what Fish and Wildlife said, and their counts, I believe, also differed. But again, I don't know what time frame we're looking at for Fish and Wildlife as compared to what the company has.
Well, U.S. Fish and Wildlife's comments were that in the pre-construction eagle and avian use study, that identified 50 bald eagles and 8 golden eagles during point counts at the Burke project area. Based solely on the documented eagle use and associated prey risk prey base at the Burke project site, it appears at first glance that unauthorized take of eagles may occur if this project proceeds to construction. So that's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Burke pretty much says there's no nests here. Most of the use was east of the 200-megawatt project area, and so they are really concerned very little on the eagle side, thanks. So this was one issue where I was surprised by how far apart the two sides are.
It did appear, at least with respect to that, that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was looking at the same data that was supplied by the agency, and they just had two completely different views as to how those numbers should be interpreted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You guys have any?
I will just point out, although it's not in the record in this case, but we've heard before in wind farm cases from people with expertise, I don't recall specifically who, when that felt that at a time we were getting too focused on exactly how far is a nest from a turbine or something. And someone with expertise, I think more than once, has testified it's not so much the distance away, it's whether you're going in the direction of water areas where they're going to want to go feed. They will go a lot more toward the water than the opposite direction. And so with this having the number of acres of ponds and such that it does, tells me that, you know, yeah, you might not have the nests right there, but I guess it seems like U.S. Fish and Wildlife's concern seems legitimate that the nests are probably in the surrounding areas and that this would be prime feeding ground.
Okay. Any other thing else on eagles?
No. I think that basically what we have with the eagle situation is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the company just have opposing views as to the impacts mm-hmm. this project would have on it. So.
Okay. So they kind of agreed on, not agreed, but acknowledged mitigation on whooping cranes, Dakota skippers, and native prairie. Correct?
I think that's a fair reading of the evidence that's in the record.
I mean, they still clearly have concerns about the whooping cranes, but, you know, acknowledge that the mitigation on the transmission wires is, you know, effective. And
they acknowledge that it's a mitigating factor.
Yeah. Ryan?
So the company has biologists that they bring in, Dr. Wells, et cetera. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has biologists. They both do the same study, come up with different views, understandably different motives. But I'm just trying to, from looking at the record, do you weigh them the same? Do you weigh them how you want to weigh them?
Well, ultimately, that's up to you.
And which biologist to believe more than
right,
the other?
You know, if I'd kind of describe it as you're the jury, the judge and jury in this case. And if we're at a jury trial, one side's going to have a bunch of evidence saying that their side's right, and the other side's going to have a bunch of evidence saying that their side's right. And ultimately, you have to make a determination as to whether the company established their burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence or not. So the amount of weight that evidence is given is ultimately up to you.
I guess I knew that answer, but sometimes it's good to be reminded.
The Sprague's pipit, is also a endangered species, right?
It was.
No?
If it wasn't endangered, it was of concern.
I think it's threatened.
Threatened.
I believe it's threatened.
Threatened, okay.
I just was through that testimony this morning.
And
I don't have it with me. I stand to be corrected, but I think that's what was said.
And I wrote that one down. Now I can't recall where I saw the concerns. Is that a native prairie issue, the Sprague's pipit? Lex. I can't find it. Should have marked these by issue.
I could get back to you on that.
Okay. Dang it. There was quite a lot of talk about it.
It is in here. I'm just looking for it right now. Page 13. Actually, last paragraph on page 12 in the top of page 13.
Sure. Particular concern is the Sprague's pipits. Pipits were historically found throughout much of North Dakota, but the species range has contracted in the state. The Burke Wind Energy Center, particularly the transmission line, overlaps with one of the few places in the state where a high concentration of pipits still persist. The project could impact the core area for pipits, including the risk of increased mortality.
And with the Sprague's pipit, I know Ms. Wells testified that the highest concentration of their habitat was in the 300 megawatt area. And that had been eliminated by reconfiguring the project,
yep.
But they hadn't performed studies with respect to the transmission line for the Sprague's pipit. So,
but it was the Game and Fish's May 2018 letter that was referencing the concern in the Sprague's pipit.
Yes,
so it was before the project was shrunk.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. So then I think that the other issue is the lex, the grouse lex, one other, you know, species that were identified. And here again, it seems to be a difference in, you know, he said, she said. But basically the company's contention here is that they're avoiding these by the setback that is recommended, right? All the identified lex, of which there are 20 confirmed in the 200 megawatt study area. And so they've moved them. All the turbines, Derby said, in the 200 megawatt project are located more than 1/2 mile away from all lex identified during surveys. So that's the remaining issue then is if there's lex that haven't been identified.
Pretty much. That's, yeah. I think, what both, I believe it was Fish and Wildlife and Ms. Smith's report indicated that there was that possibility outstanding as far as concrete evidence on that. I don't know how we would really either prove or disprove that unless somebody else submitted a map that was contrary, but I do know that was a concern that has been raised with respect to identification of grouse lex.
Do you recall it's very cyclical? I mean, the population of sharp-tailed grouse is cyclical. Sometimes they're thick out at the ranch, and sometimes there's, you know, hardly enter, and it seems to go in, I don't know if it's 5-year, 7-year cycle, whatever. Mm-hmm. Are there more lex during higher population periods versus low population periods if they're in a down cycle? Or is it proportionate? I don't even know how that works.
I don't have an answer for you on that.
I never dreamt a few years ago I'd even be asking questions about a grouse lex.
My grouse lex lecture in law school, I guess. But,
so you don't recall anything being mentioned?
I don't recall any evidence as to whether there's a direct correlation between the number of lex and the current population of sharp-tailed grouse in the state. I would imagine it's, you know, it's common sense would say that it would be dependent on that particular location and what the population is at that time. But again, I don't have any.
I would think so too. But then again, I look back at like the deer population, and they generally have the same areas that they rut in, you know, regardless of how many are there, whether it's half or twice as many.
I don't know the answer to that.
Just curious.
So he did also say Derby. So for the company that it is a species of conservation priority by Game and Fish, which is not reflected in our rules or the law. Like, they don't get any special treatment. But that the sharp-tailed grouse are hunted annually. They aren't unique in North Dakota, and you know they occur in surrounding states, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, it's not like an endangered species, or even a species. What's the other language we call of concern?
Species of concern.
Yeah, species of concern. Okay. Anything? Any other issues on grouse licks?
No, I do not. I don't want to even define my question as an issue. We're just trying to recall.
Yeah, yeah. So then the one kind of one more overarching issue that I wanted to throw out, which is the whole issue of the wind energy guidelines and how the company used them and the disagreement that exists between the company and both agencies on the consultation that occurred. Both Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife continue, even after the project was reduced in size, to say that they raised their concerns early on, and that's the whole point of these wind energy guidelines. In this area should have been flagged for non-development from day one, and the company ignored their concerns and proceeded to do their studies and development, even acknowledging, I think, that they've signed a power purchase agreement first and developed, then went through the development of the project and the studies. So, you know, that's unfortunate, and it's a concern because, you know, how, if you don't use those guidelines and follow them and negotiate in good faith with these agencies at the front end, then how do you have development that takes these issues into concern or into consideration?
Yeah, and I think your summary of that was pretty much what U.S. Fish and Wildlife said. It was their opinion that the tabletop studies should have precluded this area from consideration from the start. I know Ms. Wells provided quite a bit of testimony on that issue and explained that we have the desktop study that showed there was a concern here, and we have a couple different options. We can either abandon it or we can mitigate it. And after we perform more studies, on-the-ground studies, which she said they did, and then based on their on-the-ground studies, they continued to take mitigative steps. Mm-hmm. So really you have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service saying that we think that our wind energy guidelines should have nipped this in the bud from the start, and the company was saying, well, we did look at the wind energy guidelines, and they provide multiple avenues for proceeding with the project, and we believe that we've mitigated to the extent required by those wind energy guidelines. So that's essentially where the rub is between U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the company, I believe, on that particular issue.
Yeah, the company would say that they did follow the guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines do appear to be voluntary as well. So there is that.
So I went out and looked at these guidelines again. We talked about these extensively at a previous hearing, not this project. But, you know, it is pretty clear that the one of these steps is modification, mitigation, and abandonment. I mean, those are all steps that are envisioned in this guideline based on, you know, what kind of situation the project finds itself in. So, I mean, that's the continued concerns that this that these agencies have with this project, despite some, I think, substantial mitigation. I mean, the shrinking of the size and the moving it, you know, 7 miles away from the Lostwood National Wildlife Refuge, and there's some substantial mitigative measures taken by the company, but does it get it this project to the point of having minimal environmental impact to the environment, and does it mitigate irreversible, irretrievable commitments of natural resources? You know, the effect of the proposed route or area on areas that are unique because of their biological wealth or habitats for rare endangered species. I mean, and then problems raised by federal agencies. These are all factors listed in the law for us to be guided by. And there's some pretty big red flags there that still remain, despite substantial mitigation. So, I don't know that there's a lot more analysis that we can do. Do you guys have additional steps you'd like to take? Or what I would like to say that would have been exceedingly helpful, because there's some comments that the company made that I still have questions about in my head, and they weren't answered because Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife didn't attend the hearing, so they couldn't be cross-examined by the company and us. But when the company says there's other projects similar to this that have already been approved by the commission in also unique areas, and they when they were saying that they objected to some of the agency's own data, I perked up and was waiting for some really substantial evidence in terms of what it was they objected to. I didn't get a lot. I mean, they vaguely identified a couple other projects. They weren't even sure which ones, and couldn't really, unless I'm forgetting, point to specific things that they said they don't agree, and the company, and, you know, they don't agree with the agency because in X, Y, and Z case, they said something completely different, and they're contradicting themselves. Did you, am I missing some points like that, Brian?
You know, I think the biggest point of contention that was fleshed out at the hearing was the statement from Game and Fish saying this is some of the best land. Mm. And the company explained that that was a subjective, it was an opinion, which, I mean, I guess I'll leave that up to you to determine whether you believe that opinion or not. And they did give some information to support that, you know, this maybe isn't as good as what Game and Fish is talking about, and some things like that. But it appears, at least here, that we did have contemporaneous correspondence from the agencies to the hearing. It's not like everything was based on the 300 megawatt project, and it was easily disposed of by that. So I think that would have probably been the primary issue where mm-hmm. there was a substantial explanation as to where they felt that one of the agencies was wrong. And then, you know, with respect to some of the studies, there was some explanation as to, especially with the ducks, how they differentiated the comments from Game and Fish to what their studies showed. But again, that's all on the record, and I'll leave that to your sound discretion to determine how you want to weigh it.
All right. Where are you guys at with this? How would you like to proceed?
You summed it up very well in terms of, I think you mentioned the red flags, there are significant concerns with the project, unlike those that I've seen in my limited, admittedly, time on the commission just the last several years. But I think this is the fourth wind case I've worked. Well, take that back, maybe it's five or six now. They're coming in really quickly. So, but anyway, that's not the point. and you've got two conflicting opinions from biologists or, you know, whomever the experts are in a particular case. The fact that, so Game and Fish provided testimony, but they didn't have someone, actually a representative at the hearing.
Yeah. They didn't really provide testimony.
Well, they did.
It wasn't sworn testimony. It wasn't even, it was just their letters that came in.
Well, is that considered?
It all goes to weight.
Less in terms of?
It all goes to weight. It's whatever you want it to be. It's evidence. So it's.
You make this sound like it's very.
A lot of weight on your shoulders.
Yeah. Subjective in nature, when I think it's process, citing process is more objective in nature, but.
You know, if I could, from Fish and Wildlife or Game and Fish, I'd like to see them point to something and say, you need to be set back so far from this thing. And they just don't do that at all. They have concerns over wetlands. Which wetlands? They don't say. And
do you think the company spelled that out, though, in those two instances or examples that you just gave in terms of, okay, they move 7 miles. That's a very tangible number, obviously, from Lostwood. But in terms of the individual wetlands and the impact that they also acknowledge on wildlife, I don't see where they're citing specifics. You see a lot of numbers that are really ultimately on both sides,
other than,
if you want to call them sides, general in nature.
Other than their delineations so that you can go and see where all the wetlands are. and they didn't talk a whole lot about the roads going around wetlands. That was their objective, is to miss the wetlands when you put the roads in. You don't put turbines in wetlands. It's just that simple, you know.
Well, you don't build structures, period, in terms of in wetlands.
They can put transmission poles in a wetland, but you couldn't put a turbine in a wetland. First of all, they go up on hills anyway.
You know, at this point, I don't. I don't know what else I could personally look at and see that we don't already have, and wait accordingly.
I would maybe see one thing that I guess I would like to see. You know, a good writer can write something up and make it seem very persuasive. We have the company's proposed finding of fact, conclusion of law and order, obviously, for approval. I guess at this point, there's been a lot of discussion, and it is a balancing act. It's not like these are always easy decisions. I would like to see Brian draft up a proposed finding of fact, conclusion, law, and order that makes the case for a denial based on the adverse environmental impacts that we've been discussing, and that the agencies raise concerns about, and that you can, or that we can look at those two comparative orders then and weigh and contemplate. But it's not my portfolio. So.
Sounds like a good idea. I'm fine with that. Okay. Anything else? We've only got 5 more minutes till our next meeting anyway, so it's good that we allocated an hour and a half. I figured this would take a while.
So you're talking two orders, one that would either be approved or not approved to approve the project, and then one that would be approved or not approved to deny the project.
Correct. We have the one to approve the project.
Right. Which can be approved or not approved to begin with.
Well, it'll depend on which one I or I guess one of you guys bring to the meeting.
I think just to clarify, I think I understand what Commissioner Christman's asking, but it's a proposed findings of fact, conclusion of law, and order that would ultimately lead to a denial for your consideration, and then you just take the two orders, and obviously they're not probably going to look exactly like they look now by the time you add your own terms to them or whatever, but and then you'll get to see both sides of the coin and then ultimately make a decision as to whether you're going to approve or deny the application.
We need to weigh this closely and make the right legal determination that will stand up when it's...
Well, I'm good with two orders, but I think we can make that determination just based on one order. It's either a yes or a no, but I'm good with seeing a second one.
Yeah, me too. Okay. Nothing else?
I don't.
All right. That concludes the discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to add one more thing. Since I did not do this at the beginning, or at least I don't believe I did, but for the record, today is Monday, May 13th, 2019. We began at approximately 1:03 on the work session, and we're concluding at approximately 2:27 p.m. And we are completed and adjourned. Thank you.